Yeah, viikograafikko. Visuaalisen viestinnän maagikko. Vastaukset antaa kirjasto. Hän on todellakin viikon graafikko.
This is indeed graphic designer of the week. And for some of our listeners who have been listening for a long time, they might notice something's different this week.
Right.
Something's not quite right. Oh yeah, I know what it is. They're speaking English this week.
Wow.
Yeah, that's it. And that's because opposite of me, a warm welcome to Amy Helera.
Good.
Good.
Very well pronounced.
Thank you, thank you. We practiced a little bit before we hit the recording button here. But very glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And you're a graphic designer. I had a look at your website.
Yeah.
And it states that you are a Latinx graphic designer based in Helsinki. I had to Google this.
Right.
But it means that you're of Latin American origin.
Exactly. And the X is basically because in Spanish there's the difference between feminine and masculine with the A or the O. So Latina, Latino. And when you say Latin X, it's basically pronounced Latine. And that means that you're also including a queer pronoun. So it could be like a non-binary as
right,
well.
Right. Okay, yeah. And you've been hanging around here in Helsinki for some while now.
Right, yeah. I came to Finland because of Aalto. So I arrived here maybe 5 years ago, which is crazy. And yeah, it has been such an experience. But yeah, I came because of graphic design. I went into the visual communication program, and afterwards, I graduated, and then I have just been like really going around.
Graphic design unites the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
And have Aalto and Helsinki been good to you?
Absolutely. I have had a lovely time. I think it has been exactly what I was searching for. And whenever someone is like asking me about what has your experience been like here, I always like recall how faithful the whole situation was, because I had just graduated my bachelor in Italy, and I had been for, 3-4 years doing my bachelor's there in graphic design as well. And while being there, it was such a practical approach. Of course, it's the bachelor, so you have like a very practical approach, but there was no theory. There was no questions about like, why are we doing this, or what kind of theory can we feed our practice and this kind of stuff. It was very much like boom bam, this is Italian design, you do it so, and this is how you design an Italian book, and this is how you do that and stuff, which I mean I appreciate because I got a lot of practical skills. But when I came to Aalto, and shout out to Arja Karhuma, who really did a wonderful job at feeding us lots of theory, and there I grew a lot in more of a critical design practice.
Right. Do you think it because the specific college you went to in Italy, or do you think that's Italy as a broader culture?
I'm not completely sure. I have friends who have studied also in northern Italy. I was in Florence. And I understand, of course, Florence has much more of a tradition in terms of like arts and culture. I will definitely say that the art studies in Florence were crazy. Like my art history class was like insane, because
they have a lot of history and art in that country.
So you basically step outside of the university and it's like, okay, let's go to this like house of this famous artist and this kind of stuff. So there has been a lot of very cool trips that the university organizes in those terms. But I think that, well, my friend who is from northern Italy has said that for him it was a bit different. It was still a bit hard to overcome the tradition of like Italian tradition somehow. But simultaneously there was, he's from Bolzano, I think, and he said that it was a bit more critical in those terms. So I'm not completely sure, but I'm just very glad that I came to Finland and this is exactly what I needed, which was like a critical approach to design, and that's
sounds
what I got.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And so you did an MA here?
Yes.
Yes. And now you're just living the good life as a graphic designer.
Yeah. yeah. And I had worked for Aalto for a while, but simultaneously I have been doing a lot of different projects. And one of those you might have seen is Suur, which we have been active from, I would say, 2022, so not too long ago. It's quite recent.
Yes, let's talk about your work, because on your website, you say that your design and research aim to visualize, advocate for, and support efforts that aim for systematic change. And this SUR, or SUR, is a part of that.
Exactly.
But what is it?
So, SUR is basically south in Spanish. And we started this collective with some friends in Aalto 3 years ago. And it started as a response of all of us being really angry.
That's good.
Yeah, which is the best thing, because then that's what really unites people, you know, being angry at the same thing. And we were just very angry about the fact that in our way of learning within the university, we weren't really being told the whole picture. A lot of us were or are from Latin America, and I say were because the board has changed along the years, so now we're different people. But back then, I mean, still, of course, we were all students from Latin America, and we were all kind of very, very interested in the fact that decolonization, or, for example, when we talk so much about sustainability nowadays in every possible way, it's like a bit of a, what would you call it? Like, it's just a word that it's utilized a lot. And I think it has sort of lost a bit of its meaning, perhaps. And when we were being taught about, like, hey, like, how do we do sustainable this, sustainable that?
It's a marketing term.
Absolutely. And it's like, if we're talking about sustainable transitions and, like, green deals and all that stuff, it was completely Eurocentric. And we understand, like, we are in a European university. However, we were like, when we talk about sustainability, it's not a European issue. It's a global issue. And we were wondering, why does the university not incorporate, like, Southern epistemologies in the way that they address this global and, like, urgent, like, alarmingly urgent issue, like climate change and sustainable transitions? They are an issue that should be considered for, like, the global audience.
Right. And how does SUR tackle this then?
So we started as a grassroots kind of more activist-based thing, and we were doing interventions. So, for example, we made a few manifestos, and we made, like, one of our most beloved actions was when we grabbed, like, a very simple thing that we thought no one was really aware of, which is this Chiquita banana. Because Chiquita banana, it's also, in terms of graphic design, it's like...
It's a classic.
It's a classic. It's, like, yeah. Iconic. However, the background of Chiquita banana, it's extremely bloody. So the thing we were like, okay, so what we'll do within this intervention, bring in the Southern epistemologies, which is, like, very common knowledge in our households. It's like, Chiquita banana is a bad brand. So you, for example, I'm from Guatemala, and Chiquita banana is basically responsible for genocide in Guatemala.
Oh.
So it's a, yeah, joints.
I saw a documentary on this. Does this have anything to do with United Fruit in the 60s? And
so the United Fruit Company is Chiquita banana.
Oh, but right.
Rebranded, yeah. Basically.
Oh, okay.
So there we go actually this Ruben Pater in Caps Lock, he addresses this as well in one of his chapters. He talks about, like, the power of rebranding for, you know, profit-making and absolving guilt. So basically, Chiquita Banana, you know, they have such a turbulent history with the CIA, the United States. They organized, like, orchestrated a coup in Guatemala, which led to an internal war, which led to genocide. Like, so it's, like, completely orchestrated by a private company that's still, like, so iconic and beloved today. And so we did an intervention in which we first did a workshop on how to do vegan banana cupcakes. And then we were all in the kitchen talking about the histories of bananas and, like, different people were addressing, like, what were their memories of this, like, Chiquita Banana? Did your mom ever talk about it? Did your grandma ever talk about it? And after that, we took the cupcakes to the main square, meeting between the metro and the entrance to the art school. And there was a lovely sunny day, so everyone was outside and it was perfect for us. And then we were there with a bunch of, like, boxes, you know, from Co-Market or Alepa of Chiquita Banana. Bananas, and we had this cupcake stand, and we had a lot, like, infographic and, like, info leaflets, which, you know, they are important, because when I was designing them, I was like, we have to make them kind of a bit ironic, in a sense of, like, it's a bit, we call the series Nasty Delicioso, so Nasty Delicious, and because it's, like, kind of the dark history of food as well, that probably it's not as acknowledged in territories that haven't had to deal with that. So then we did this whole, like, online library with all the history, you know, of, like, different books, different articles that document the history of Chiquita Banana, and also the design part of it. So because most of us are designers, so we have always incorporated design methodologies and ways of acting through what we do. So within that action, what we would do was basically get people to talk to us by offering them free banana cupcakes. And then we would be like, do you want this banana cupcake? And they're like, yes, amazing, thank you. And but did you know?
Right, so a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, because I was having a look at your other projects and they were in a similar vein. You're involved in something called forest as a geopolitical stage as well. And yeah, it has to do with logging and protecting the forest.
Yeah, that was a very, very interesting project. I was brought in by Satu Herrala, who is a super great researcher. And this is one of, like, my greatest joys, is actually being able to work with research projects, because there is a lot of very cool and very important and urgent themes touched within the research field that I just love when I have the opportunity to be able to visualize them. And in the forest as geopolitical stage, I was brought in as the visualizer for the project, and it was 2-3 days in the Finnish National Theatre, and they were basically, you know, addressing the problem in Uruguay, especially with the UPM pulp mill there. Was a super powerful weekend, and we did, like, a couple of pieces that were poetry pieces commissioned from different activists and artists that were talking about the logging, the forest, the, you know. So there was, like, someone from Uruguay, a Sami activist as well, and there were, like, this merging of worlds within, like, protecting the land in different ways. And what my task was basically how to visualize this in also three languages, because there were, of course, the English translations, but initially, you know, there was Spanish as well, there was Finnish, and we had to visualize this around the theater. So then there were, like, different screens here and there, and how do we then make the installation stay and be relevant for the people that are visiting the theater as well.
Right. So, in other words, listening to you, scrolling through your website, I guess you wouldn't be comfortable designing for fur companies or big oil.
Absolutely not.
No. What I'm saying is, yeah, I'm seeing someone who sees things in society that are not right, and you try to mend them. Hmm. But what made you choose graphic design as your weapon of choice?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I actually, I think, well, of course it wasn't, like, planned in a way, but it sort of happened. And it happened in a way that, I mean, when you grow up in a Latin American territory, I think, like, if you have a consciousness, you are very aware of, like, the dichotomy of, like, oh, wow, I'm so privileged to be, like, very well off. I have an education, I have, like, food, I have all this stuff. And then you realize, like, the absolute injustice, which is systematic. Like, it's a very systematic thing. I will say that my mother was also a very big influence. She was always working with NGOs and this kind of thing, and I would go in the field with her sometimes and, you know, go into these coffee farms to teach women how to be independent from their, like, abusive husbands, and how to, like, give them kind of autonomy over their own fields and this kind of stuff. And I was, like, very much admired what my mother was doing, and that definitely influenced me. She was always very like, you should be aware of the situation in the country, and whenever you are able to help, you should help. So kind of this was the ideology that I kind of grew up with. But that didn't stop me from getting into something like arts. So.
No, but I mean, revolutionary posters are a thing.
Absolutely.
And have always been. And I'm wondering, is this history of sort of revolution, visual language, is that something that you incorporate into your own work? Or how does your visual language work when you're fighting for good?
I think a lot of our main word for that in my practice would be representation. Because I think that representing a cause, or representing an ideology, or something that is usually shadowed by some bigger epistemology, or some, like, you know, like hegemonic kind of way of thinking, and it never really maybe sees the light of day as it should because it's underrepresented. So for me, making like a fair representation of what I'm talking about is very important. And that might mean like either representing a person or representing, you know, a cause in a way that engages and kind of, I don't know, makes justice to the idea. So it's not, you know, I well, for example, the project we were talking about before in the forest as a geopolitical stage, for me it was very much like, how do I make justice to this like pressing, urgent issue? How do I get people's attention and also interest in this like very important thing that we're talking about? So in my visual language, representation is kind of like the main thing, is basically how do we then are able as designers to use the elements that are important for these people. So for example, in that project, it was like very much theater and very much like moving. So, okay, it being a visual identity that moves and that kind of fluctuates within the spaces of the theater is a very important thing. And also the timing of the text that it's like able to be read from very far away, for example, in the screen, so people kind of, you know, are interested as well and are able to receive this message. And so the action of making things
inclusive, I guess.
Yeah, and also use things that are like important for the people working on them. So I recently did a project for my friends on this Redket project, which also talks about like forests and stuff. It's very new, so it's like just released, and they deal with the knowledge in forests in the Helsinki area, and for them it was so important to use something that looked more like mold or mushroom or moss. So there was all these elements of like, we really feel like this will represent our idea somehow, and the whole identity was based on that, like, let's use things that remind us of mold and things and stuff, and let's use it to visually translate your idea, because it's important for you to use these elements as well, like within your work. So this representation of ideas as well.
Preach. We'll talk about more about this in just a second. This is Viikon Graafikko, aka Graphic Designer of the Week. My name is Kasper Strömman, and opposite of me is the lovely Amy Helera, graphic designer of the year, if you ask me, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. And in this program, we have a very special segment called Packaging of the Week. And I will play you the jingle right about now.
Visuaalisuus ei on meidän rakkaus. Katsotaanpa siis viikon pakkaus.
What do you like? How do you like the production value?
That was very good.
My secret ingredient is echo.
Oh, I'll take note of that for when I have to do a jingle.
But Amy, what are you bringing us this week?
So I'll describe it for our listeners while I show it to you. So this is the packaging I'm bringing for you. Directly from Guatemala, of course. Maybe it was a bit expected. But can you hear? For sure you can hear this.
And let me tell everyone out there, that looks wild.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I do love the colors of it.
Yes. So this is a packaging. What I'm showing Casper is basically a cardboard box. But what's important or kind of special about it is the colors and the illustrations on them. They are very, very colorful. There's like very basic representations of fruits. It says Las Delicias, Dulces Típicos, which is like the delicacies. Was it like typicos? Because typicos, it's like typical, but it actually means like original, like, or kind of like our own, like the local candies.
Can I have a look?
Of course.
What I love about it is, well, let me tell you, it's yellow, but there's also red and green and magenta and purple and orange and all these colors, which I assume could be traditional. Colors of Guatemalan dresses, maybe, or
yes. So I think what this packaging is really trying to do is like implement those colors within the packaging, but slightly kind of failing at it because it's like, of course, it's these very basic colors, right? Like this red, green, and purple and magenta. But kind of there is a bit of a, if you see the actual dresses and the actual like color used in textile art, for example, it's like so much more beautiful.
Of course, of course. And I do have to say this, there's a color picture of a lovely spread here of different
candy.
Yeah, it's candies, but some of them look like actual fruits.
Exactly.
Here. Yeah, and the colors are slightly off.
Yes.
But only adds to me.
Yes,
to the charm of it.
Exactly. That's what I really like about it, is that it's just colors all over the place. And it's like such a staple in like households, because you go to the market and then, or you go to the store, Las Delicias, and then you get like a box of candy. And it's like they haven't changed the packaging in many, many years. So, I mean, I think since I was born, so then it kind of retains. And you can see it in the picture. You can see the picture is very, like, kind of 90s coded.
I'll put this out on my own Instagram. But yes. What I'm saying is, this is what I'm looking for when I'm abroad.
Right?
You know, because we live in a world where everyone gets more and more homogenized. You get your Coca-Cola and they all look exactly the same
absolutely,
all over the world.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And also up here in the north, we obviously have the cool Scandinavian design.
Oh, yeah.
Where everybody gets a bit the same treatment as like just take away elements. Mm. There's none of that over here. No.
No personalization, huh? So.
No, but what I like, it's a horn of plenty. It's a cornucopia of colors and goodness.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like delicious. It's kind of, you look at it and it's like, I'm about to get a lot of sugar from this. And and now, because I didn't want to throw the box away, because I did get goodies from my mom in this box. And now I have like little tea bags in it.
Fantastic.
So it kind of works, you know.
So, and are the sweets inside, are they any good?
Ah, yes. Absolutely. Okay. And they are all handmade. So it's kind of like this very specific tradition of candy. There's a, I don't like marzipan, but there's like, I think these fruits are made of marzipan. So then it's like very cute representations of reality in a very tasty way. Like, you know, you have like an edible pear and like a banana made of like this random thing. And it's very, very good, I will say.
Come on, I'm getting hungry here. But yeah, that is very cool. Thank you, Amy, for bringing that. It made my day. I asked you if I should know anything about you before you showed up here this morning.
Right.
And you sent me a link to this website, which is called The Cyber West Manifested in the Corporeal Rest.
Yeah, a mouthful.
Yeah, it seemed a bit much to start with. But I read it dutifully, and it's basically an essay about you, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah,
basically.
By you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's called Decolonization of the Self, a Visual Autoethnography.
Yeah.
And first of all, I mean, you should check it out. The website is thecyberwest.cargo.site.
Yeah.
And CyberWest Manifest in the Corporal Rest Research Methodology. And it has this wild graph that represents you, where you call it a Fluchtpunkt.
Yeah.
Where you break yourself down to 7 points.
Yep.
One, mixed ethnicity, Guatemalan and a Filipina. Two, female assigned at birth. Three, gender queen. Four, person of color. Five, born into middle class. Six, heteronormative family. And seven, bilingual.
Right.
And these are all starting points for this journey of an essay, if you will.
Mm.
And it's basically, if I got it right, about how in your native Guatemala, advertising always uses stock photos of white people, which doesn't really represent the common man or woman or genderless person on the street.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And there was a lot of examples, and obviously they use the corporate, the people selling you stuff, they use these same American banks,
yep,
where you find this.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, yes, this is very much what's happening all over the world, I guess, and also over here. But what would have to be done to change this?
Right. So before answering that, I will give a bit of context on that essay, because it's attached. It's basically an extract from my thesis. So my MA thesis was basically about the visual colonization of urban spaces in Guatemala City. And I chose as a subject of interest, a very, very transited street that is joining two different departments in Guatemala. And I mean, I don't know, I have gone through that street as a living in Guatemala many, 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 many times. And I always remember this, like, uncontrolled amount of, like, billboards in that street. And most of those billboards are covered in this, yeah, like, white people. And within that context, like, in the thesis, I talk about how, like, Guatemala has one of the highest rates of indigenous people in Latin America and, well, in the world. And how is it like most of us are definitely not white? So it's like, how do we really then take this? Like, what is the effect on that? And I evaluate my own personal experience as a child. Like, how did I feel about, even though the fact that I was, like, as I mentioned in my crazy graph, which is basically trying to get to my intersectional position. So
it was very informative. I was
right?
Humoring.
No, but yeah, I mean, I agree, it's the crazy, because I made it purposely, like, very asymmetric and very, like, non-graphic, because very logical, because I thought all of these things, they are not uniform, right? So there is, like, all kinds of shape when I think about, like, religion, or I think about, like, gender or this kind of stuff. And when I have evaluated my own kind of experience or the impact these kind of visual colonization of advertising has done to my self-image growing up as someone who has dark skin and that perhaps doesn't see herself reflected in any of these advertisings, then, like, how do I really now as a adult reflect on those experiences that I had as my younger self? And that was what the essay was basically about, or that side of the methodology. And then within the conclusion of the thesis, basically, I talk about, like, what would be a possible solution for this. And the thing is a bit more complex than you would expect.
Because,
okay. Or in my opinion, I'm also back then, because I made this 2.5 years ago or 3 years ago, I published this thesis. So I would say that my reflection on doing this kind of research was that, well, first of all, like, what kind of advertising do we need? And, like, why is it that the visual culture in urban environments is mainly advertising, right? So then, like, how can we also counteract against this kind of also... At least, like, Guatemala has a very unhinged neoliberal system in which, like, the urban spaces are, you know, not very well regulated. So if you want to build a billboard, then you just go ahead. So very US-like, in a sense. And I was thinking, like, do we really need, like, this amount of advertising? And then so, like, would it be kind of... my main question was, like, is it... If we would do, like, for example, stock photography banks that have better representation of other kinds of people, I was also like, I went through a lot of stock photography for this research, as you will, if you visit the page, you will be able to see. And I was thinking, like, this is kind of horrible. Like, I don't like stock photography. And there's also a reason why I'm not in advertising. Sorry to all my fellow designers that are in advertising. But I also, I mean... I also felt like this is not like the best visual culture we can have either. So it goes back to the roots of capitalism and neoliberalism, right? Because this is why we have advertising and why this has become a visual language as well, is because of the market need, right? But I think that overall I was like, I don't think the future is having like more varied, which already exists. There's like this colored people, stock photography sites. So, you know, there is like a lot of different solutions. You will think that is the solution, but I don't think that is the solution. I think we need to reevaluate as visual practitioners, like what the need for advertising is and how should we address this. And so it's a bit more about not representation, but I think I would have probably had like a healthier upbringing if there wasn't as much advertising as there was in my daily life.
Right. I'm thinking of maybe a French city, or it might have been somewhere else where they actually banned advertising. But then just to clean up the visual landscape. But then I'm thinking, like, do people then just come up with other ways? So maybe, I don't know, parking a van somewhere, which
has. I mean, but I think that's even, like, that's much better, right, than having, like a infested city of people. Of course, for example, Helsinki is very different.
We got advertising.
You get advertising, but if you have been to the US, for example, you have noticed it's a bit unhinged, and we have inherited that from the US. And if you go to Guatemala or any other like countries in the global south where like neoliberalism has been kind of like imposed as well, because I have fellow designers from India and like Vietnam, for example, and they say there's the same thing. And in India, they're like, oh, of course, there's a lot of white people. There's a lot of like this, I mean, not in India, but in the advertising representation.
Yeah, and that's what I actually saw some interview with some Bollywood actress, and she was like, yeah, some people have darker skin, but especially in the movies, they use these creams and powders. And then they shoot the film and then they put on some kind of Photoshop filter so they look even whiter. And, you know, when it's out, they're completely white.
Yes.
And somehow everybody is against this, but somehow the industry is such that for some reason it can't be changed.
Yeah. And that's a... And that's an eternal struggle, isn't it? Like the industry can't be changed somehow. So.
No, but have you thought about it? Well, one step would, I guess, then be to regulate the advertising a little bit.
Absolutely.
But do you need like an, I don't know, indigenous rapper or someone who's a bit darker, who brings out that pride maybe of being of...
Right.
I mean, you've clearly thought about this. I mean, are there any steps to take towards a more diversive... visual landscape.
Right. I mean, I think, like, in my fantasy world, we don't need advertising as much as we do now. We need advertising, not to necessarily, because of course most of the advertising are meant to sell you something, right? So that's like the purpose of that. I think it's a different thing when you're doing a public service announcement. I think it's a different thing when you're doing something like when it's something that might interest you culturally as well, that might like nourish you somehow. That's a very different thing, because you might want to find out and you might like you might need the correct way of displaying information, and that's the kind of thing. But the whole like psychological thrill of selling to people, and like how do we manipulate your emotions and your things, and how do we then arise from that? Because I think I don't think like any indigenous people will be interested in participating in advertising, for example. It's like it's beyond them. It's like, well, this is not something we actually need to protect the lands.
Right.
So it will be like, you know, like there is a bit of a very distant relationship between those two, because I think indigenous people would be more interested in actual problem solving. So for example, if I've seen, of course, there's a lot now with indigenous people being more present in the media. So now you can see like this Brazilian and also this like Nordic and this Latin American overall, like indigenous people participating in campaigns of social interest. So of course you can see that. But however, I don't think that we need it for very capitalist reasons. Like, I don't think it would even solve anything. It's like, you know, what has happened with rainbow washing or with green washing, wouldn't it be the same, right? Like, it would be like kind of washing it with like indigenous people in order to sell you all kinds of things. So
yeah, I guess it's a big question,
right,
which can't be answered in one essay.
So that is why I'm like, systematic change is a very interesting thing to me, because bit by bit we go building these blocks, but I think those blocks are very heavy and we need a lot of people to move them together, because when we think about like things like capitalism that are in charge of many, many things of how we operate day to day, you also think about like, how do we as designers engage in this? It's like, oh no, I'm not kind of in charge of this. But there's a lot of people that are doing efforts that do need our help, need our assistance, need our visual knowledge and engagement in order to be able to fulfill the mission to transmit this knowledge to others.
Well put, we'll be back pretty soon. This is Viikon Graafikko, also known as Graphic Designer of the Week. I'm Kasper Strömman, and with me today I have Amy Helera, super graphic designer. And Amy, now we've reached the point of this program where we go for a hot take. And don't mind if I play a little jingle on that.
Hot take. Se on meidän motto. Suomeksi hot take on tietty kuuma otto.
I don't know how well you speak Finnish, but kuuma otto is basically a crap translation of hot take.
Right. They keep getting better, I will say.
My jingles.
Yes.
You're my favorite guest so far. I mean, what can I say? But you did bring a hot take.
I did. I was really struggling. I was like, do I really? I think I'm a very diplomatic person. And then like I asked my partner. He was like, no. And I was thinking like, okay, I have like some like more generalized hot take, and then I have like a more design based hot take. So
take your pick.
Let's see. So I think in terms of design, my hot take is that we should all be free to stretch type as we like.
Oh, that's very controversial. That's super controversial. Okay, for those listening who aren't very into graphic design, this is probably something they teach you, the first thing they teach you when you go into college, like never stretch type. Just choose another typeface. There are literally millions of typefaces. You don't have to stretch type. But here comes Amy, and you know, she burnt the rule book ages ago. She doesn't care. She stretches type.
Because for many, many years, because as Kasper said, I didn't allow myself to do it at all. Like, why would I do that? Like, it's against everything I have ever been taught. So, for this, for example, Sur, you get to experiment a lot. And I think, like, many listeners maybe who are in the design scene will know that there is such movement as the anti-design, which does everything against the design rules. But I think we should be able to play a bit with the shapes and, like, of course, there's many things involved when you might engage in the danger of stretching a type. But now that we think about, like, display fonts, for example, if you stretch a display font, for our listeners that might not be, like, familiar with the term, it's basically a font that it's a bit more or like ornamental. So it's something that, and if not ornamental, just something that is meant to be displayed in a way bigger format, so as a title or as a banner or something like this. And nowadays we have so many of them that come in such funky, fun shapes, and there is, like, very, very nice and entertaining work. So if we don't talk about this like clean international school of design kind of thing, I think we should be able to have more fun with the rules of stretching in terms of type. Maybe if you care too much about it being readable, which for display fonts, it's not a thing that much anyhow. So if you just want to fill up a space and kind of do this wonky kind of thing, I think, why not try it out?
You know what? When I was younger, I would probably have hated this hot take. But now I'm matured. I'm like, go for it. Stretch the pipe. But was it hard for you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was very ingrained in me as a designer. Like, no, never. I have to choose. If I just want to feel like a horizontal space, then I should just choose a white type and that's it. I shouldn't stretch it. But I kind of have done it recently. So I was like, I think I started stretching type over the last year.
That's good. Amy Helera, a true rebel, right, bringing her hot take on type. Thank you. I like it very much. I'm bringing you my hot take, and it's from the world of moving pictures.
Okay.
Yeah, I know it's weird, but I couldn't think of anything else.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay. Long one takes are utterly pointless. Do you know what Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I just heard a podcast about this movie that was made in one take, French movie.
Exactly.
Yes.
And also, was it 1917, this war movie? It's done in two takes or something.
What?
Ridiculous like that.
Wow.
And all these directors go like, yeah, it was really, really hard and we had to do it so many times to get it right. I was like, but why?
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't look better.
No.
It's only so you get to feel better about yourself that you manage to, I don't know, do this challenge for yourself.
Yeah, that is a very interesting one, and I will say I agree, because I also think that at some point you might, I mean, the whole film industry, I guess, has developed so many things that it can look like a one take if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And this French movie, I really forgot the name because it's in French and I don't speak French, but it was done in one take and there was so much like admiration and this kind of, like, that's crazy, like, technically so cool. So maybe for them it's like technically, maybe like for us, like choosing like the hardest way to do like a poster and then it's like, look at my craft and all these things, and for people we're like, why did you just print it like somewhere else?
Yeah, like try again, but now with several days.
Yeah.
And you know, everyone's guarantees it will be more visually pleasing.
Yeah.
So 99%, I dare say, would actually like it to there to be more takes than one, but what do I know?
Yeah, well, we have to bring in a filmmaker next.
Amy, I'm so glad I got that off my chest, because I've been thinking about it for a long time. Thank you. But hey, back to you. And I'm thinking, you're clearly a thinking person. You have a high moral. Is it very hard for you to get a job?
Yes.
Yes, I thought so.
And that's why I am also a big fan of Finland, because
right. There
is such thing as a scene of people that care about this stuff that I care about. So all these, you know, researchers and people that are engaged in these very, very deep subjects that do I will say, stop cutting arts, give us the chance to really work on this stuff for us that want to also contribute to a better alternative to our future, to our bleak future right now, which we are like, ooh, what the hell? Every summer gets worse and this kind of stuff. And it's like, fundings are such an important part of me making a living.
And grants, I guess.
Grants, yeah. Absolutely. So thanks to Grafia as well. I got a grant last year.
Grafia is fantastic. They fund this program.
Yes, yeah. We love you.
No, but I'm also thinking, so clearly you did a BA in Italy and MA over here. Has being a designer changed you as a person?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I think my day-to-day life is very different. And my expectations of life are very different because of design. And I will say the fact that I'm in design means that I also have other friends that are in design and that have perhaps some very unique takes about different stuff. And I learn so much from them. And from different people around me that have this, like, you know, you notice things, you make things, you create things. And, like, I just feel like my life is so different because I pay attention and I also try to engage with things that are created and made around me as well. Like, you know, of course, everything with the packaging section, for example, you know, it's like something that definitely changes when you walk into the store, perhaps. But also the fact that, for example, I have in Aalto made like product design friends as well. And they also have taught me a lot about like day-to-day living and objects and that kind of stuff, for example. And it just definitely changes the way I go around things.
Right. Mm. But you don't have to work, say, as a sandwich artist on the side.
Yeah.
You manage to somehow do something for a living now.
Yeah, for now, because I think that is also a bit of a struggle in this sector of things. Because I will quickly just say that to whoever feels like they are struggling with their morals and getting a job and all that stuff, it is hard. It is hard, and you don't get the best salary and all that stuff. However, I think that we should still push. And for example, what I have done for a long time is do part-time job. So part-time as a designer at the university, and then part-time doing projects here and there. And that has sort of like also worked out a lot of financial things. So for sure, I mean, if you want to live, you need to make some money.
Yeah, that sounds like actually a great existence. Have you thought about, if not graphic design, what would you do?
Oof, I think... Well, when I was younger, I really wanted to be an astronomer. That is something that I really wanted in my life. But then I met physics and I was like, ooh, I suck at this. But I think today, perhaps, I could really see myself working in some kind of caring, more blue collar kind of job.
Sure.
Like, I think I really like children, for example. I wouldn't mind.
Nothing wrong with children. They're great.
Hey.
They're smaller than normal person, but still great.
Yeah, exactly. I really like children. They are pretty okay.
Yeah.
So I think I would really be like in children care, you know, like a päiväkoti or like something like this. I think it would be fun.
You could teach them to stretch fonts.
Yeah. From a very young age.
Yeah, just
radicalize them.
Yeah, radicalize the new generation.
Yes.
You know, we talked for a while now, but I'm thinking, can graphic design make it change or a difference even? Can you change the world through graphic design?
Yes, but not alone.
No.
So
you need a movement.
You need a movement. You need a community. You need people that care about the things you care about. Design is definitely a key piece of how we do things and how we transmit this very important information, and how do we represent these ideas, because we as designers know the impact that design can have on the way that we perceive things and how we interact with things. So definitely, I think like design can change the world, but not by itself. Definitely, you need people that are moving in different places, and you are just part of that moving piece as well. And I think that's a very important thing, because, well, now I do freelancing, and it might be a very lonely kind of practice when you're doing like individual freelancing. But for example, I believe that whenever I'm able to be part of a bigger team, I feel much more confident in the way that we can do things together, because, I mean, the bigger team not being only designers, but being, you know, people that are like in social research fields, or people doing art curation, or people doing producing.
Yes.
Like things. And
power actually, in numbers.
Exactly.
Yes.
So
we're running out of time, unfortunately.
Right.
But before we go, yeah, I know, this has been lovely. But is there anything you would like to recommend to the people listening to this?
Yes. I think if you don't know about this press yet, but if you haven't heard of Rab-Rab Press, I recommend you look at their books. There is a lot of historical and very interesting essays published by them. They are an independent press that work a lot with research and different movements, like radical movements over history. Very, very interesting reads. And one of them would be The Sugar and the Hunger, which I have here from Rab-Rab Press. And it's a very interesting, quick kind of read, heavy read, but extremely insightful. So please check them out. They are based in Helsinki. So please, 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 please.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Amy Helera, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Same here.
Next week we'll be going live for the Graphia Festival. But until then, take care. Bye.
Bye.
Hän on luovuuden haulikko, viikon graafikko. Hän ei ole mikään utuvikko, viikon graafikko. Hän on visuaalinen maagikko, viikon graafikko. Tietä mikä on apinalaatikko, viikon graafikko. Hän on viikon.